morning.
So last time we talked about some very high level stuff about, well, we're talking about processors. What do processors actually do? And why should you care? We mentioned, well, you know, we're going to talk about how processors are built, but there's a lot of things related to that that understanding that should help you with. And we kind of previewed two themes that will come up a bunch later in the semester of parallelism, that processor designs that are efficient do multiple things at once, and caches, that processor designs that are efficient have sort of special storage that's faster than the normal storage. But we looked at first sort of the very simple model of processors, which didn't have these features. So we had a processor connected to a memory, and we learned also connected to I/O devices. And the memory is kind of this dumb storage of bytes. It doesn't know how to do any computation. It doesn't know what those bytes mean. The processor asks for some bytes, does something with them, asks for more bytes, sometimes asks to set bytes, via some communications line we called a memory bus. And you know, the processor needs to ask both for bytes to figure out what the instructions are, getting the machine code for the instructions, and for actually manipulating most of the values those instructions deal with. But we mentioned that, oh, well, the processor has some values it stores itself. Notably, it has to store somewhere where the current instruction it's working on is. We said that was stored in the program counter. And it also stores what we call the register file, which are the registers you're used to using in assembly. And we'll see when we talk about processor designs, maybe there's some other things the processor might store. Since we were talking about retrieving values from memory, we had this issue of endianness, which you probably saw before in 2150, but it comes up a whole bunch of times. So we went over it. And this is what comes up from when we have multiple pieces that we need to combine into one value. This comes up with memory, because in memory, we have an index at which we can access every single byte. But very often, we aren't accessing a single byte. We're accessing a bunch of bytes and treating them as one value. And we need to decide how to do that. And endianness is the decision we make about how to do that. And in this class, we're typically going to be using what is called little endian, where when we want to make a number for multiple pieces, the piece with the lowest address, the lowest index, is going to be the ones place. It's just an arbitrary decision, but we have to make one, because we have multiple ways when we have four bytes we know make up a number to combine them into that number. We also looked at a little bit of assembly, which will be our main topic for today. We did sort of a review of x86 assembly, where we had the issue of, oh, wait, we can add values together and instructions to computer memory address, and that's different than, you know, taking a value from memory and adding it. Has a different syntax. So before I go on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Any questions about things we covered last time? We're all reasonably happy. Yes? So the question is, talking about registers, we have registers that are divided up into pieces, which we alluded to, and we're going to talk about more today because I have the slide. And the question is, when we access EAX, which we learn know is part of REX, is that the least significant 32 bits? Yes. That's just what the designers of Intel chose, because probably it being the most significant 32 bits would not be so useful. They could have chosen the other way around, just probably would be annoying to deal with in assembly. Other questions? Okay, so one piece of logistics. I mentioned we're going to have quizzes, including one that's assigned tonight and due before lecture next week. And these are using an online quiz tool, which will look something like this. This is not the actual one because our quizzes are not called example quiz. and you won't see a greater site link or anything like that. So you'll have a quiz, and you can open the quiz, and you'll have the option to, I have the wrong quiz. And I can't, of course, have this so I have the worst possible view of my screen. So, we have a quiz here, and I still have this, so I have the worst possible view of my screen. Why did I not? Oh, I see what I did. Okay, so we open a quiz, like one that's actually not marked as closed, and then you'll have a place to write answers. Some of the questions might be write a short answer, usually just a number. Some of them might have you choose from bullets, and when you enter an answer, the box around the question will turn green. Your answer is recorded. You don't need to do anything else. If it doesn't turn green, if it stays yellow, there's some sort of network problem, got logged out, something like that, and your answer is not recorded. If you want to check if your answer is recorded, you can just refresh the page. You'll reload the quiz, and your answer should be there. Also, the quizzes don't have to be taken in one sitting, so you can close the window, open it, go back to the quiz site, change your answers, whatever's recorded last, that's what we're going to do. All the questions have a place below them to write comments. Please show any work here, or if you think I made a mistake in the question, which happens, this is where you talk about it. Generally, we won't be able to answer questions about the quiz, because if someone takes the quiz on Thursday night or Friday morning, and then you discover Friday afternoon or Saturday that there's something wrong with the quiz, we can't really tell them, hey, sorry, you started the quiz early. Too bad for you. So we're not going to do that. Instead, we're just going to do our best with the quizzes written. If that means we have to drop a question, we have to drop a question. But that's how we're going to deal with any problems in the quiz. And you know, about half the time when people think they found an error, they haven't. About half the time they have. So also, those questions we can't really answer. And obviously, like myself and TAs in office hours, we will not answer quiz questions for you, but if you want to go over lecture material, that's 100% fine. That's generally what the quizzes are about. So you have answers, and there's some, so you can select answers, and the quiz is going to close when it's actually due. And once the quiz has closed, it should be auto-graded, like you can see here. So you can see the correct answer is marked with a T for the true-false questions, and you have a score here. And the percentages would be the percentages of students who gave each answer. Do I have an example? Not here. I do have an example, right. And for example, if you entered a comment sometime after the quiz is due, if you entered a comment, we will have feedback on your comment once a grader has looked at it. Obviously, if the quiz is due at 9:30, you won't see that, you know, at 10 a.m. It's going to take us longer than that to actually go through all the comments and decide that. And sometimes, instead of just seeing a response saying that's not really, doesn't really matter, you might see a grade adjustment. So questions about the quiz system? Yeah.
Generally,
how many questions is the quiz? I usually aim for equivalent of 4 or 5 multiple choice questions, multiple choice or short answer questions. Yes, and the quiz is untimed, open notes, open book. Yes, question about?
That was my
question. Yeah, open notes, open book. Don't ask people the quiz questions. You know, don't put it on Stack Overflow. Don't. I am your friends. How do I answer the quiz question? But otherwise, use whatever resources you like, and you don't have to do it in one sitting, so you can look at it on Friday, figure it out over the weekend or something. And to find the quiz site, if you go to the main course website, there is a quizzes link up here for the real quiz website, not the demo one I'm showing you now. And the quizzes will be released sometime in the evening after lecture, so if I don't get to what I expect to get to in lecture, I don't ask you quiz questions about it, which I think you prefer. Yes? No. So, I might have a link that's not correct. Please tell me exactly where that link is. Like in an email, tell me where that link is, and I'll look at it after this lecture. But the link on the top of the website definitely works, and if there's broken links, I'll try to fix them as soon as possible, but not live. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's go on to actual lecture material. So, as I mentioned when we introduced assembly, we're going to be doing AT&T syntax instead of Intel syntax because that's what our textbook chooses. It's also the default on Linux for GDB, GCC, and so on. And we're going to go over just a very brief introduction to what AT&T syntax looks like. Here are some side-by-side examples of the two, but I'm going to go through in sort of a slower way. So let's start out, with this example of an instruction in AT&T syntax. This moves the value 42 into memory. The place in memory it moves that value is determined by the number stored in RBX. So the number stored in RBX is an address. That's used to move the value 42, and the value 42 is an 8-byte value. And we can see some general rules of AT&T syntax here. So one thing is that the destination is last. It's always going to be true. So it's just the opposite of what you're used to with Intel syntax, just what they chose. And when you see parentheses, that generally represents a value in memory. Just like in Intel syntax, square brackets generally represents a value. When we have a constant, it starts with a dollar sign. If we didn't have that dollar sign there, it's still valid, but it represents a memory address. So the constant says, this is not accessing memory, this is just a number. We see our registers always start with a percent sign. Something that doesn't start with a percent sign is a label, like the name of a function, global variable, something you can jump to, and so on. We have this instruction is not called move, but move Q. What's the Q? The Q represents the length the instruction works on. So for this move instruction, there's another move instruction that instead of moving 8 bytes, moves 4 bytes, a 4-byte integer called a 42 into the same place. So we need to know which version of move we're using. The way we tell is with this Q. And if we wanted to have 4 bytes, that would be L, 2 bytes would be W, and 1 byte would be B. Questions? This example here. Yes?
So if you don't include the letter to indicate length, does compiler try it?
So the question is, what happens if I don't include the letter to indicate length? For this instruction, I'm not actually sure what happens, but either there's some default the assembler assumes, or it doesn't assemble. Now, for a lot of instructions, we don't actually need to include the letter at all because there's only one length it could be. So for example, if I have move RAX, RBX, RAX and RBX are 8-byte registers. There's only one length there could be, so I could put the Q there or not, and it doesn't matter because it's unambiguous. But this instruction here, the original one, is ambiguous. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Can you explain again why you use percent sign?
Can I explain why I use percent sign?
Yeah.
So the percent sign is what AT&T syntax uses to represent a value from a register, something that's in that register file that's stored in the processor. If I don't use the percent sign, it's going to treat it as a label. So by a label, I mean like if you know you have like loop, you know, and have a jump to a loop, it's going to say that if I see something that's just text, I'm going to think it's one of those. And that you had one of those called RBX for some reason. Is that, even though that doesn't make much sense, it's allowed. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So then we have some other things about accessing memory in more complicated ways. And this is the main place where AT&T syntax looks a bit weird. So if I want to, you know, compute the address at which to access memory, the sort of general syntax looks something like this, where this specifies RBX plus RCX times 4 plus 100, which you in Intel syntax did by the kind of writing arithmetic. In AT&T syntax, we have this sort of fill-in-the-blank form. And a way you can think about it is that in Intel syntax, they kind of like let you write an expression, and the assembler has to figure out if that translates to an instruction. In AT&T syntax, they said, oh, the instructions have basically these four slots for values to make up an address, and we're just going to have you specify each of the four slots. And the four slots are what we'll call a displacement, so this number to add at the end, a base register, and an index register that's multiplied by a constant, and it happens that this constant can be 1, 2, 4, or 8. There are no other values which are allowed because the machine code doesn't support them. Yes?
Sorry, what was the second register?
Second register, this is called the index. So the way you can think about this is that if you're doing an array lookup, the base register is the beginning of the array, and the index is the number of elements into the array, and this last value called the scale is the size of each of the elements. And sort of the processor has built-in support as long as the size of your element is 1, 2, 4, or 8 bytes to do this. If you have an array with bigger elements, well, you can certainly like compute how to access a particular element, but you're going to have to do some extra work. Yes. What is the multiplier? This scale here?
The
100. Oh, so the 100 is a displacement. So it's just added to the address. So a way, so if we're thinking about the array access, effectively we're saying the array is at RBX plus 100, and we're accessing element RCX times 4 of it. Does that answer your question? We're accessing by RCX times 4, which is element RCX if it's 4 bytes. Other questions? So this is the sort of most general form, and it turns out that often, you know, I'm not doing something where I need to have all these fields. Like, maybe I don't need to offset the base of my array by a constant, like this 100, or maybe I'm not accessing an array, I'm just accessing a pointer, I don't have an index. And the way that works is that I can just omit fields of this. So if I just specify one register, it's a base register. I have still a displacement here. If I specify a register and a scale amount, it's just the index register. If I can specify all of them like we saw. And also, I can just specify no registers, in which case it's still accessing memory just at a constant address. Because remember, we showed earlier that if you want to access, have a constant, that's not represented by just like 100 for the constant 100, it's represented by $100. So without the dollar sign, it's just a memory address that we compute without using any registers. And I can also omit the scale, in which case it defaults to 1. Some questions sort of about these just extra forms where we just have basically default values for the most general version. Okay. So when I started with AT&T syntax, I mentioned that the destination is last. So there's one consequence of this, which is not worth mentioning especially, which is because the destination's last, the way this subtract instruction works is that the destination is RA, and it's still the same subtract instruction you've seen in Intel syntax. So it subtracts RAX from R8. So that's the subtraction it does. And it turns out, as we'll discuss later, that compare works the same way. Compare is basically computing, doing the subtraction, and then saying if it's greater than or less than 0. So it also is sort of reversed from what you're used to with Intel syntax assembly. Questions? Yes?
Are there any instructions in AT&T that aren't flipped from Intel?
Question, are there any instructions in AT&T that aren't flipped from Intel? So the destination is, maybe? I'm not sure how some like obscure instructions are dealt with. And obviously, instructions which have only one or zero operands, this doesn't matter. Does that answer your question? But yeah, I'm not sure about all the instructions. All the instructions will use, which have two operands, yes, but there's a lot of weird instructions that I don't know how the people who wrote the GNU assembler handled. Other questions? Okay. And so, just as a reminder, we mentioned addresses. So a number with a dollar sign, that's a constant. A number without a dollar sign is an address. So this first add adds accesses memory at address 1000 hex and adds it to RAX. The second one adds the constant 1000 hex to RAX. Are both. So one extra detail, mentioning this mainly because it will come up in the assignment we have next week, is uncomputed jumps. And I'm mentioning this mainly because you'll see this dot star, which is basically just a way of saying kind of a dereference symbol like you see in C. So jump star percent RAX means that we take a value from RAX and that's an address to jump to. So the reason they just don't write jump percent RAX is because that would imply that we're running machine code that's actually contained in RAX, and that's not what this jump instruction does. It uses RAX to find the machine code to run. The value in RAX to find the machine code to run. And similarly, this instruction here, jump 100 RAX RBX R8, this, as we learned, represents a value in memory. And it takes that value in memory, and that's not where we actually find code, that's where we find a pointer to code. So it reads a pointer from there, and then runs the code that pointer points to. Some questions? About these computed jumps. I call them computed jumps because we compute a value in a very like reading a register or reading memory and then jump there. Yeah.
So if it's a star, it just means it's a pointer?
So if it's a star, it just means it's dereferencing a pointer, basically, yes. Other questions? Okay. And just as a quick check, I have just my one slide summary. Here's an add instruction. What does it do? If you little time to look at, you can check with your neighbors if you agree. What is it the most likely case for this instruction? And we have foo here, and a way you should think of labels is labels represent the address that they mark. So this foo is the... Okay. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's see. So who thinks A? B? Okay, C? D? Okay, E? Okay, so I think B is probably the best answer, but let's talk about exactly how we go through this. And it looks like, so what does this instruction do? So if we think of generally, we have an add instruction with x and y as sort of values. This is generally is going to do, because our destination is a last, it's going to do y plus equals whatever x is. So this instruction is going to accumulate some value into whatever y is. And what's y? Well, it's this thing here, which is a special case of this displacement-based index scale syntax, where we have a displacement that's omitted, so it's 0. And it accesses memory. So this is, this y is going to be memory at rax plus rcx times 8. And how do we interpret that? Well, RCX is some address that we start at, and then we use RCX as some index into that, and we multiply it by 8, so we're adding 8 units at a time for each value in RCX. So if we think of RAX as an array, that means RCX, if we think RCX as an index into that array, the array must be an array of elements of 8 bytes. So that's how I get an element of array at RAX. So RAX is the start of the array, and RCX is how many elements we go into it, assuming the elements are 8 bytes. So that's our y, and our x is this value foo. And generally, when we see a label that represents the address that that label is defined as. So somewhere, someone wrote in assembly, foo, colon, and something. And foo represents the address that that something is placed at. And based on context, presumably it's a global variable because it doesn't really make sense to add something like to an instruction like or a function. That's not really a meaningful operation on one. So this is going to be the address memory at foo. Okay. So I think B is the best answer about what this instruction is trying to do. Now there's a problem with this instruction, which you may remember from 2150. Yeah. Do we have to use percent sign before foo? So foo is not going to be a register. It's going to be a value in memory, a variable in memory. But there's a problem with this instruction that you may remember from 2150. Yes?
Wherever the array index currently has isn't clear in 4.
Question, wherever the array index that it currently has isn't clear in 4? That's accounted for by saying we add to it instead of moving to it. So we are using the prior value, you're correct. But I don't think that's a problem, that's just a choice that was made. Yes?
We can't check the bounds of the array.
We indeed aren't checking the bounds of the array. Whether that's a problem or not depends on where this instruction is found. Yeah? We're accessing memory twice. This instruction is not actually supported. Twice, not supported by the processor. So we have a way of writing an assembly. Turns out there's no machine code for it, so it won't assemble, even though it's pretty clear what it's trying to do. Questions about this? Yeah?
What is the third word that you wrote
saying that? Accesses memory twice.
No, about foo.
About foo? Oh. This foo is the same as writing the address. Writing is that word. Yes, I'm sorry. I should be careful in what I... Yes? I would accept E because it doesn't assemble, yeah. But I would accept B or E. I won't ask questions like this on a quiz, on purpose at least. And this is actually what I get for making up a question this morning and not looking at it carefully. But probably still worth discussing for reviewing 18D syntax, which I know is a point of confusion, and we didn't have a question for this earlier. Great. Okay. So let's go through another example of using AT&T syntax. So here's a simple swap function in AT&T syntax. And let's just step through what it does. So this first instruction here, so let's say we're called, we have our two arguments, which are RDI and RSI. Which are just two pointers, because that's where this function was declared in C. And my first step is I take the value in memory at RDI, so I use RDI to access memory, and I take that value and put it in RAX. The second step is to take the value in memory at RSI and use that to access memory, put that value in RDX. The third step here, remember destination last, so I take RDX and I access memory at the value specified by RDI, so I put into that dot location in memory this 77777 I read earlier from memory. And then the last instruction, I take RAX and I put it in memory at the location specified by RSI, completing this swap operation, and then I return, which, if you may vaguely remember, pops an address from the stack and jumps to it. Why is it pop an address from the stack? Because push pushed an address on the stack. Yes, call. Sorry? Can I go through that again? Okay, so our first, so we have this function, when it's called, RDI and RSI are set to our two arguments. The first instruction here takes RDI, the first argument, accesses memory at that location, and retrieves the value and puts it in RAX. How do we know it retrieves it? Because RAX is the second, the last operand, which is the destination. The second instruction takes the value in RSI, accesses memory there, and because our destination is RDX, it puts the value we retrieve from that part of memory into RDX. So questions so far? Good. Okay. And then we have two instructions which kind of do something in the opposite direction. So we have take the value in RDX, but it's not being used to access memory. There's no parentheses around it. And we use RDI to access memory. And since that's the destination, we're putting a value in memory. So we put RDX in memory at the location specified by RDI. And then we have RSI as our destination memory location. So we take the value in RSI and put RAX in memory at that location. So questions about sort of what this function does, how we read these move instructions? So this instruction here, RDX is our first operand, our source, and our destination is this parentheses RDI. So parentheses means we're accessing memory. RDI is the register being used to compute a memory address. So we take the memory address we compute using RDI, which is the same as RDI, and that's where we go in this memory here. And we need to put a value in there because it's a move instruction, and that's what move does. It was an add instruction, we'd like to be adding a value, but this is move, so we take this value from RDX, our first operand, and put it in that part of memory. Does that clarify things? Yes?
Since I'm guessing that the swap function is just prime swap, wouldn't, is it right to use the RAX parameter?
Question is, isn't it a problem that we're using RAX because that's where the return value goes, and if the swap is declared as void, it shouldn't be a problem because no one should care what's in RAX. If it was declared as something else, then we've chosen a return value maybe by accident. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I alluded to earlier that we had someone ask about overlapping registers. So as you may remember from 2150, we have sort of RAX, RCX, RBX, RDX, RDI, RBP, RSI, RSP, and R8 through R15. I don't expect you to memorize all these. You can look them up when you need them. And each of these registers, which are 64 bits, also have smaller portions which have their own names and you can sort of access independently. So for example, if you only want to access the bottom 32 bits of RAX, that's available as EAX, that gives you the least significant 32 bits, or if you want the least significant 16 bits, it's available as AX, and similarly you can get the least significant 8 bits and a bunch of other smaller portions. I've shown sort of the naming pattern here. I don't expect you to memorize all the names, but you know where to look them up. It's also in your textbook and various other places. Yes? So the question is, what happens when I mix REX and EAX? That's the next slide. So if we set a 32-bit register, it clears the rest of the 64-bit register. So for example, in this case, I move all ones in binary into REX, and then I move one into EAX. That happens to set all of REX. So it puts zeros in the rest of REX. With the 8 or 16-bit sort of version, sub-registers, it doesn't work this way. So there's two different rules depending on what size we're dealing with. This is just arbitrary. I'm letting you know so you aren't confused when you read assembly code, not because we're going to try to trick you about this. But when you're doing the assignment next week, you'll see the compiler like sometimes clearing registers and sometimes not. And it's good to know why it is. If it's writing a 32-bit register, that clears the 64-bit one, so it won't add extra instructions to clear it. If it's writing an 8-bit or 16-bit register, you need to do extra work to clear this corresponding 64-bit register. And why this works this way, my guess is historical reasons, that at the time they were moving from 16 to 32 bits, clearing the whole register would have been probably less convenient and slower. At the time they were moving from 32 to 64 bits, with the way processors were being designed at the time, clearing the register was probably a lot more efficient. So questions about these rules for how overlapping registers writes work? So we just have this special case that writing the 32-bit thing clears the rest of the 64-bit thing. Okay. Yes?
What happens if when you use moves, you have the length character, like Q, L, W, Z, what happens if that doesn't match the register?
Question, what happens if that doesn't match the register? The assembler will complain. And in these cases, I could omit the L or Q also, and the assembler would figure it out because it can only be one possible thing. Because, you know, I have to use move Q with REX and so on. Yeah. Question, would it cause undefined behavior? The assembler will probably give the some sort of assembly time error and refuse to produce output. Other questions? Yeah. Question on this slide, you can see that REX has two 8-bit sub-registers and a bunch of these others don't. It just happens that REX and also RCX, RVX, and RDX have those and the other registers don't, mostly because of the history of x86 that, you know, these registers are from originated in older versions of the architecture. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about a bit about the calling convention. This again should be something you saw in 20 or 50, but it's worth talking about. And I sort of have the summary here. You don't need to memorize it, you can look this up. But the calling convention on 64-bit Linux, x86 Linux, I should say, to be precise, is that we have six registers that we've chosen to use for arguments. And if we need more arguments than that, we put them on the stack. And the return value goes in REX. There's a figure in the book for this, where you can go back to this slide. And Yeah, we use the register RDI for the first argument, but the first argument might not be 64 bits, in which case we use the appropriate smaller subregister, depending on what the actual size is. And the typical way you'll see this in assembly is, let's say I want to call foo here with 1, 2, and 3 as arguments. I'm going to put 1 in the first register, 2 in the second register, 3 in the third one that was on this list here. And because the arguments are int, I'm using the 32-bit parts, not the 64-bit one. And similarly, for foo to return 42, it's returning an int, so that's why I'm using EAX, the 32-bit part of RAX, our return value register. Okay. Questions? Sort of what the calling convention at a high level. I guess, so in the assignment next week, we're going to have you read assembly. One thing I strongly recommend when reading assembly is using the calling convention. Like, because even though, yes, you don't actually need to know the calling convention to figure out what's happening, it sure is helpful to figure out what's, this is a function, what are the arguments, what's the return value, especially if you have a function name, that often can save you from actually reading a lot of assembly. I just say, oh, they're calling a function called add two numbers. If you figure out what the arguments are, maybe you can avoid reading the function and make an educated guess. Okay. So something else which appears in this assembly is we have a call and a return. So these instructions on x86, call pushes the address just past the end of the call instruction onto the stack. This is called the return address, not to be confused with the return value, the place we want to go when the function's done. And return pops that address from the stack and jumps. So the way this means this works is that it pushes the call here, pushes the address of whatever instruction is here to the stack, and the return takes that from the stack and jumps there. Questions about call and return? Okay. So there's one other thing in the calling convention besides where the arguments and return value are and how call and return actually work, which is about register saving. So we want it to be possible, generally, for functions to use registers temporarily. And we have to decide, you know, if I use a register, and call another function, or another function is calling me, do I have to worry about those other functions also using that register? And to solve that problem, the rules that Linux on 64-bit x86 has decided is that these list of registers are ones that functions are not allowed to visibly change. Now, they can change them, they just need to set them back to what they were before they return, so no one notices that they changed them. And this is the stack pointer. So if I call your function with the stack pointer at a particular place, it better be there when you return, even though probably you're doing stuff with a stack pointer in the middle. RBX, RBP, which historically was used for something called a frame pointer, and R12 through R15. This is just a choice that was made. All the other registers are registers that when you call a function, you have to assume that function changed. Meaning that you better not have put anything important in there, because after you made the call, it might be gone. So a way you might see this work out, this is not the only thing you could do to deal with this, but if it's something is callee saved, callee is the thing that is called, then this means that, you know, this function foo, to make sure whoever's calling it doesn't get confused, is going to put R12 on the stack temporarily, the prior value, and restore it before returning, so it can do stuff with R12 without interfering with the function that's calling it. And similarly, if you're calling a function like foo, you have to assume that any register in our list, like R11, is going to be changed, so it's going to be what we call caller save, meaning that you, as someone who's calling a function, better save it if you care about it. Otherwise, it's going to change. Or at least it might change, and you have to worry about that. So questions about caller and call these saved registers? Yes? Which tends to be more common? So you can see that the people who designed the calling convention for Linux on 64-bit x86 made a choice that we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 registers that are callee saved. And there are 16 registers, so 16 general purpose registers. So like most of them are caller saved. And that's the choice they made, but they could have made other choices, and there are architectures where the choice is like all the registers are caller saved, or almost all, or maybe the other way around. But it's, so it's a choice that's made when the people design how function calls work. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Can you explain caller versus
callee
saved again?
Sure. So caller safe registers are ones that you, as someone who calls a function, you're the caller, need to worry about saving because the function might mess it up. The function's allowed to change it. So in this example, this other function here has decided to push the value of R11 and then pop it because it's worried that foo might change it. Doesn't know for sure it will, but it might. The callee saved ones are ones as someone who is being called, you are responsible for keeping the same to not confuse whoever is calling you. So in this example, foo needs to keep the old value of R12 because whoever is calling it might care about it. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So after we call foo, does the program still read opq that line?
Question, after we call foo, does the program still need Does popq still run? So this is
popq R11.
So this call to foo returns to that popq. So that happens to be the first instruction that runs after the function foo. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes. What is callq? It's the same as call. I could have also written call foo. The queue, like with move, represents the size of the operand that it works on, which is 64 bits on a 64-bit system because that's the size of pointers. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Question, is there a downside to not using queue? No. Other questions? Okay, so I probably should have put this earlier. So I mentioned labels. So labels represent addresses. So they're just, as I saw earlier, a placeholder for the address. So that means I have these two pieces of code. So here I have a label called string, which points to a string, which I have an initial value of here of a string. And this first instruction reads from memory this ASCII here, and adds it into REX. She treats the ASCII as a number, as a big number, and adds it to REX. This instruction, probably a mistake. The second instruction takes the value of the address of this string and adds it to REX. So this is like computing the address of one of the characters in the string, assuming REX is like an index. So the second instruction might be useful. And a way we can look at this that might make it easier to understand is that I could have replaced string with an address. So let's say string ends up at address 10,000 hex. I could have just replaced every instance of string with 10,000 hex. And the add instructions would be the same. Now, I can't really do this, but only because I can't put a label that's a number. But other than that, sort of acts the same. Yeah?
So
Why would we add the constant of the memory address to REX? So if we think of C, this would be equivalent to, like, if I had a string equals a string, and then I had a pointer, and I set the pointer to, like, string plus X. Which maybe you'd be more familiar with this being written as the equivalent getting a pointer to the X element of the string. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So now that we know about function calls and labels, here's an example which takes a string here. We take the address of the string and put it in RDI, and then we call this function called putS, which is kind of like printf, but simpler, which takes a pointer to a string. So I have a pointer to my character pointer, I put in RDI, and then I call it. So I have my hello, I have an assembly syntax to specify a constant string, I specify, take the address of the string, not the value, the address of it, so that's what the putS is prepared to take, into RDI, where the first argument should be, and then I call putS, it returns something, but I ignore that and just return. So questions about this assembly code? Yeah? Can I, the call puts, so this is the same as call puts. So this jumps to the puts function and sets up so puts will return to the next instruction, return to them. Does that answer your question? Where is the puts function? So not in this assembly code, so somewhere else in this program there must be the puts function. And if we're thinking of our system, it's going to be defined by, it's going to be in a library that we're going to include when we make our executable, just like printf or like cout and so on.
Is that function also written in assembly?
Question, is that function also written in assembly? So probably it was originally written in C, but that C got compiled to assembly, just like this probably came from C that was compiled to assembly. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so since we understand this, here's an exercise. So we have a similar call to putS, and my question is, what are we actually passing to it? This code. Give you a minute, you can check with your neighbors. Thank you. like some more time still? Okay. Okay, so let's see. So who thinks A? Okay. B? Okay. C? D? E? F, some other string. Okay. G? H? I? Something else? No clue. Okay, so we have mix of a clue and we have a lot of answers. So we literally have some problem figuring out what's going on here. Okay, so that's maybe first thing try to show which might help is that if we, how is this string stored? So we have the ASCII for H, for E, for L, for L, O, and these are each 1 byte, and that's what's stored at the address hello. And remember, labels kind of act like addresses. So if this is stored at address 10,000, then this here is 10,000 plus 1, address 10,001, which is going to be taking, means the address of this E here. And remember that if there's no dollar sign, it's not an address we're representing, it's the value in memory at that address, not just the address. So this is going to load the E, and it's going to load 1 byte into BL, which is the bottom part of RBX, the least significant 8 bits. And then we subtract 1 from, remember we had subtract from because the order is different, from that E to get D. If we look at an ASCII table, turns out that they're contiguous, which, so if they weren't, that would be really confusing. And then we move that back, and again we have, we just replaced this with OX 10,000 if it was 10,000. And it's not moving it to an M constant, it's moving it to the value at that address. So I have explanation slides. So what we're doing here is we have our, we move D into their string, so our string ends up being del O. And then we have this final move here, and this is moving the address of hello as a constant. We aren't accessing memory because the dollar sign means constant, not a memory access. So we're getting a pointer to that string that we're passing as RDI. We aren't actually passing the bytes in the string directly in the register. We're just, the register contains the address of those bytes, which is good because putS is declared to take a character pointer, not like a bunch of characters. And so that's how got the answer B. Some questions? How I figured it out? Yes. So the question is, what would, if I had instead had $hello plus one, comma, percent BL, this would be attempting to move the address of the second byte of the string into BL. That probably doesn't work out the way you'd want because BL is 8 bits and the address is 64, but that would be what it's attempting to do. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Can I go over the difference between hello and dollar sign hello? So, for example, in this example, I'm saying hello is an address 123456 hex. Dollar sign hello, this dollar sign hello means is the value, this whole thing, I should say, is the value 0x123456. If I wrote just hello with no dollar sign, that means read from memory at 0x123456. So how we do that is we take these bytes here and we turn them into an integer. And that would be the value we need instead. So we'd have an integer which would have the ASCII for D, E, L, L, and O combined together. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Given that RDI only has 8 bytes, like you only move first 8 characters of hello world.
So the question is, if I had the version without a dollar sign, would I only move the first 8 characters? Yes. Because of RDI size. Other questions? Yeah. Question is, so the question is, what's happening when I add 1 to hello? Why doesn't that take into account the size of hello world? So I guess there's two things going on here. So one thing is that labels in assembly typically don't actually know the size of the thing they're labeling. So they're just a point in memory, is how you should think of them. And the other thing is sort of, in assembly, when we add to addresses, we always add in units of bytes. Does that answer your question?
So is like move B basically telling the assembler to only grab the first byte of
the assembly? So question is move B telling the assembler only grab the first byte? So move B says that it's a 1 byte move. As far as where we move from, we're gonna take the hello, which is the start of the string, and add 1 to it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And that's the location to move from, not the value to move. Yeah.
What if you wanted to get like a subset of the string? Like, would you have to move B into individual bytes, or could you?
Question: if I wanted to get a subset of the string, would I have to move B to get individual bytes? So I can move in. So there are move instructions for 1 byte at a time, 2 bytes at a time, 4 bytes at a time, 8 bytes at a time, and I can use any combination of those I want. I have to figure out how to choose what addresses to give to match the parts of the string I want somehow, though.
Okay.
That answer your question?
So if you did like move W, hello, would that move like HE?
Yes. So that question, if I move W, hello, move HE as an integer, which might not be a useful form, but it would do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we move D to hello in the third
The question is, this move B into hello, because we're moving to hello and at hello plus one, we're changing the first character, yes?
And the second question is that action string is hello with calculate, so does that matter?
The question, since the string is hello with calculate, does that matter? It's just a different number that's stored in this first byte initially. Because if you look up in an ASCII table, you see what the number is versus the number for a lowercase h. Yes?
What if we change BL to, for example, RBX?
What if I change BL to RBX? Then move B is not a valid instruction anymore. If I also change the move instructions, then I'd be manipulating a bunch of characters as integer and then converting them back to characters, basically. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, so if I did move W, that would move H, E, not E, L. So I made a mistake there. I was looking at the wrong instruction. It would move E, it would move these two bytes. If we change this to move W and B, L to B, X. Yeah. Can I explain the dollar sign hello plus one that I wrote here? So someone asked, what would happen if we had a dollar sign? Would that take the address of, and we learned that would take the address of this E here and try to move it into BL. And that instruction is probably not useful, primarily because BL can't fit an address.
So does the dollar sign work on
the dollar sign indicates we're not accessing memory. So we're just taking a value. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so this took longer than I expected, so we'll talk about, next time we'll start by talking about LEA, the instruction that I think confuses a lot of people in 2150 that we'll see, and then we'll, and some other assembly topics, and remember we have a quiz. See you next week.